It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a proposal from the U.S. Department of Energy would change the way electricity is priced, giving a boost to the coal and nuclear industries. An energy expert gives us the details.
First, the United States announced this week that it plans to pull out of the United Nations Educational, Science, and Cultural Organization, better known as UNESCO. The Trump administration has cited mounting costs as well as a perceived anti-Israel bias from within the organization.
UNESCO is best known for its cultural preservation work and its list of protected World Heritage Sites, but its relationship with the U.S. has been rocky from time to time, and the United States has left UNESCO in the past.
Colm Lynch is a UN-based senior diplomatic reporter for Foreign Policy magazine. Colm, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So, what would you say is behind the United States' plans to withdraw from UNESCO?
As you mentioned, they've always had a rocky relationship. I mean, I think the issue that really tipped them in the direction of making the announcement this week was that back in 2011, the U.S. Stopped funding UNESCO, and we used to pay for about 22% of their budget, about $80 million a year, because of legislation which prohibited the U.S. from funding U.N. agencies that allowed Palestine in as a member state, which UNESCO did. So what has been happening is that the U.S. is still a member and has been a member since then, and it still gets charged for all of these, you know, these tens of millions of dollars worth of obligations, and those have been building over the years. So it looks like the Americans are in debt of sort of north of $550 million, and so I think there was a lot of pressure to stop the bleeding, and that, you know, they were other issues involving, you know, resolutions, you know, periodic resolutions, which would recognize very sensitive religious sites in Hebron and other parts of the region as Palestinian sort of heritage sites, and that was sort of offended the Israelis and the Americans. So there was some tension over that. Also, the Americans cited, you know, sort of frustration with the sort of reforms that they'd hoped to be implemented. It was sort of ironic today as the, you know, all of this played out in the week that the UNESCO was selecting a new director general, and they just announced the election of the first ever Jewish director general of UNESCO, Audrey Azoulay, the French candidate, which was kind of interesting.
Is there anything to read into that choice?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I doubt that that played into the calculations of Israel or the United States. But I think it's kind of interesting from another perspective, in the sense that there was an expectation that this was the Arabs' year to have their first director general, but there was this other sort of, you know, intramural kind of squabble going on between countries behind two of the key Arab candidates, the Qatari candidate and the Egyptian candidate. And Qatar, which was leading for most of the period, was sort of, you know, virulently opposed by the rest of the Arab world, particularly those who support Saudi Arabia and Egypt, and wanted to back the Egyptian candidate. So in a sense, they ended up kind of canceling themselves out. And when the Egyptians lost out, they encouraged all of their followers to back the French campaign. So I think this fight over Qatar and their kind of increasing diplomatic isolation sort of ended up, you know, tipping the balance towards Azoulay and undermining their own chances of getting an Arab at the head of the organization.
And you had written that the French were very hopeful and that the United States would stay engaged in UNESCO. What was at stake for France?
Well, for France, I mean, I think this is a broader question for France, which is, you know, that they are, you know, there is tension not just between the French and the Americans, but all of the European allies and much of the rest of the world over, you know, the American sort of the withdrawal from the Paris Agreement, the big climate change agreement, and the French have a lot invested in that. There have been sharp differences over the President Trump's decision to decertify the Iran nuclear deal, which has broad support from the Europeans. So this is for them another sign of the Americans kind of disengaging not supporting close allies on issues that are important to them. So I think that, you know, they had hoped that the Americans would back this. When President Macron of France met with President Trump in September at the United Nations, he personally asked him to support the French candidate. And apparently, you know, Tillerson, who was in the room, kind of, you know, walked up and said, well, you know, actually, we're thinking of pulling out of the organization. And apparently Trump replied, well, maybe we can vote for your candidate before we leave.
Talking to Colm Lynch right now, a UN-based senior diplomatic reporter for Foreign Policy magazine. We're talking about the United States' decision to withdraw from UNESCO. And Colm, let's talk about UNESCO in the big picture now. Can you tell us a little bit about what UNESCO does, the type of work that they do, and what the main bodies of action that we might recognize them for are?
I mean, the thing that they're best known for are their famous heritage sites all over the world, and they kind of identify and try to protect important historical sites around the world. And so, you know, that's what everybody kind of knows them for. But they also, I mean, they were established after Second World War. This principle of making access, scientific information, education accessible to large numbers of people was kind of at the core of their mandate. There have been a lot of sort of ideological battles. They have been viewed in the U.S. and also other capitals in Europe as, in previous years, as sort of anti-Western, as having, you know, viewed in Washington, particularly by conservative governments, as too, you know, as kind of pro-Soviet. So there were a lot of these kind of Cold War divisions, which kind of increased tensions among countries. More recently, the United States under George W. Bush under President Reagan, we had pulled out of the organization before, back in 1984. President Bush brought us back in, and it, you know, it seemed like there was kind of, you know, more basis for cooperation on education, supporting education and all around the world, in Africa and other parts of the world. So that they do a broad range of issues. One of the things that they seem to be kind of moving in the direction as trying to play a bigger role in issues involving the role of privacy versus controls over the internet versus freedom of expression. And that's a very kind of sensitive issue. I think having the French, you know, sort of in the lead, if UNESCO goes in that direction, is probably better than having some of the other candidates like China and Egypt, for instance, which was another one of the front runners in this campaign. So that's one of the areas that is seen in the future as something where you're going to see a lot more activity from UNESCO.
You were talking about the era when the U.S. pulled out over Cold War divisions. How does that movement under the Reagan era compare with what's about to happen, it looks like, now in the Trump White House?
Well, I think it's, you know, it reflects deep cultural kind of reservations about UNESCO, particularly among conservatives. So it's not surprising that it's the Republican Party that's doing this. I mean, my sense is, this came as a bit of surprise to me because, I mean, the Americans have been focused, they've been very critical about other UN agencies, particularly the UN Human Rights Council. And for some of the same reasons, that it's sort of excessively critical of Israel, and that countries with bad human rights records try to get onto it so that they can protect themselves. So I would have thought that a move like this would have been more likely involving something like the Human Rights Council. There hadn't been a lot of attention, a lot of focus on UNESCO. They didn't seem to be paying attention to it. But I think, you know, the State Department is also very concerned. They're in a kind of budget-cutting mode this year. And, here's $500 million pot, which they have to pay, and which I don't assume they will pay anytime soon. But, you know, they see those numbers going up higher and higher, and they kind of wanted to stop the bleeding right now.
And how does this affect UNESCO as a whole, with the United States looking like it's going to be making an exit in the near future? What changes for UNESCO?
Well, I don't know that much will change because, you know, they weren't getting the money anyway. So essentially UNESCO after 2011. I mean, as I mentioned, 22% of their budget was came from the United States, so they had to make do with 22% less in their budget. And you know, they reached out to other countries to make contributions that were not part of the regular budget. I mean, like countries like China, which, you know, rarely do voluntary funding to international organizations, you know, kind of stepped in and was providing, you know, several million dollars for you know, teacher training programs in Africa. They gave them $5 million to stop, you know, to republish, you know, an old, you know, quarterly magazine that they used to put out called The Courier. I mean, I think for China, they see this as an opportunity to have an impact on issues that they care about. Like,
and we leave it there. Colm, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right. Thanks for having me. Take care.
Colm Lynch is a UN-based senior diplomatic reporter for Foreign Policy magazine. He joined us to talk about the United States' decision to withdraw from the United Nations Educational, Science, and Cultural Organization, better known as UNESCO.
Right now, Secretary of Energy Rick Perry has proposed a new rule that would change the way electricity is priced on the wholesale market. If it becomes a reality, electricity coming from plants with a 90-day backup supply of fuel on hand would get more expensive.
Coal and nuclear power plants would benefit the most from the change. While the Department of Energy says the rule will ensure grid reliability, critics say it's supporting industries that aren't competing with natural gas and renewable energies like wind and solar.
Gary Radloff is the director of Midwest Energy Policy Analysis at the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Gary, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now, this energy subsidy, basically, it gets complicated pretty fast. Can you give us kind of the basics and the timeline of what's going on here?
Yeah, and in fact, I might clarify that I think it's a little different than a subsidy, and we can talk about why it might be different, because what's going on here, I think, is being proposed as potentially the biggest change in energy markets in a decade. And in fact, some people have said it sort of blows up what we already have, which is a competitive wholesale market. In April, Department of Energy Secretary Rick Perry ordered an internal study at the Department of Energy on electric grid reliability. And some of the critics of the Trump administration said they thought the study was going to be a Trojan horse for some of the pro-coal and pro-nuclear policies advanced by the Trump administration. Now it's sort of proving to be true. In August of 2017, the staff report to the Secretary on Electricity Markets and Reliability was released. And the report done by the staff was largely factual and primarily called for more study and better data on from the grid operating organizations. But then just a few weeks later, in September, Secretary Perry issues what's called a Notice of Public Rulemaking to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which regulates the wholesale market, to create rules giving added compensation to power plants that have a 90-day supply of fuel on hand. And that's something pretty much only the large coal and nuclear plants, what are sometimes called baseload plants, have. He asked that the interim rule take effect within 60 days, which is just incredibly fast for something this complex. And so, you know, the question as somebody who studies energy policy, you know, I ask you know, what's the problem that Secretary Perry is trying to solve? And my observation was that looks to be a solution in search of a problem, and because there really is no linkage between having a 90-day supply of fuel at, you know, basically a very select group of energy generation facilities, coal and nuclear plants, in terms of, again, this issue of grid reliability. So that's kind of the background there, and you know, from here we can kind of dissect that further.
Yeah, Gary, how would this work? Does this mean if I have one of these big, say, coal power plants, I keep a 90-day plus supply of coal, I can charge more for the electricity I provide? Is that it in a nutshell?
So we don't know exactly how it would work, but by and large, what they want is that if you have this 90-day supply of fuel, which would basically be stacks of coal if you're a coal plant, or for nuclear plants, they always have their energy supply on site, that in this wholesale competitive market, you would get a higher level of compensation for your energy in the wholesale market. So, again, it's not... I hesitate to call it a subsidy because it's actually really what it's just saying is in this competitive market, the commission has to allow you to have a higher level of payment or compensation.
Coal is big in Wisconsin. We've talked about that on the show before. We are pretty dependent on coal. Is this something, if it went through, depending, of course, on how the rules are written, as you say, is this something that could mean that electricity consumers in the state end up paying more?
I think over the long term, yes, but you do have to also kind of delineate that for the most part, people in Wisconsin, what they pay for their electricity comes from the retail market, and the retail market is regulated in the state by the Wisconsin Public Service Commission. So, but the wholesale market, you know, can sort of set the global price, if you will, for what energy is selling for. And so it can definitely impact eventually on consumers. But I do like to distinguish, you know, again, with the wholesale market and the retail market, it's kind of a separate world.
We're talking to Gary Radloff. He's director of Midwest Energy Policy Analysis at the Wisconsin Energy Institute, looking at possible changes to the way electricity charges are set, wholesale charges. Complicated issue, a possible rule now from the federal government. As I understand it, Gary, this original proposal was dialed back somewhat after the initial response. Some parts of the country wouldn't be affected, but Wisconsin, if I'm reading things right, still would be. Is that right?
Yeah, again, there's a lot still to be determined because the Federal Energy Regulatory Commissioners would have to really determine the details of the rule. But from what was originally being discussed, they made some changes to say that they really wanted it to only apply to what they call merchant plants in the ISO and RTO jurisdictions that have energy and capacity markets. And so right now, of these 10 organizations, six of them have capacity markets. And the Mid-Continent ISO, which is where Wisconsin is a participant, has a voluntary capacity market. So it isn't clear if we're in or out under the proposal as it now exists, so a lot still to be determined. But we would find out if they stick on this timeline. We would find out at least what they're thinking in the next 60 days.
Let's talk about this issue of grid reliability. The idea that we want to have reliable source of electricity, even in the event maybe of disruptions in the market or some kind of disaster. Is there something to be said for, in some way, subsidizing, whether it's through a direct subsidy or not, somebody, a power provider who has this huge capacity and a big stack of their energy source in the backyard?
Well, I think it's a pretty weak argument because really, what occurs in these type of situations is if you have something very catastrophic, like Superstorm Sandy, which hit the East Coast a few years ago, it's going to knock out power over a swath of an area. And if you have just one large generation plant in that area, that means that pretty much everybody's going to be without power. So I think it's a weak argument to say supporting a single type of generation large baseload source is going to really help you with reliability. And in fact, I could make an argument for a completely different way to deal with reliability and resiliency.
Do you see the motivation then behind this proposed rule just to try to prop up the coal industry that's faced declines largely because of natural gas competition?
Exactly. You know, that's where if you actually read this 100-page report that the DOE staff wrote, the biggest change that's occurred in the wholesale market is the growth of lower cost natural gas generation facilities. And then the second biggest change has been the growth of primarily wind generation, which has also become very affordable and competitive in the wholesale market. So what's occurring are these actually these large baseload coal plants and large nuclear plants are not competitive in the wholesale market anymore. So you're taking a competitive market that seems to be working, because one of the goals of Congress and FERC when they created the wholesale market was to bring prices down, make it more competitive. You're finding that, in essence, what the Trump administration is saying, well, these uneconomical plants, we're going to support them.
What is the timeline looking ahead for this rule going through the process and maybe being implemented?
Well, again, the Secretary Perry called for an extremely fast timeline, and he wanted an interim rule within 60 days. A lot of observers think that's just almost an impossible timeline. And in fact, the FERC staff have issued about 4 pages of questions that they still have on how this rule might be implemented. And they are taking testimony from various market participants on how this would work in the wholesale market. So I think they maybe will try to issue some type of decision in 60 days as to whether this is sort of even possible. And then I think the timeline will then be extended for the details of it. And then we'll see where it goes from there. I also anticipate that there might be a legal action challenging this, so that would extend the timeline.
Gary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Gary Radloff, Director of Midwest Energy Policy Analysis at the Wisconsin Energy Institute, breaking down a federal proposal to boost prices for electricity that comes from coal and nuclear power plants. First, a good movie can have an exciting plot, but a great movie has a plot line and amazing food. Think about it. The smell of popcorn isn't all that makes your mouth water when you're looking at the silver screen.
Have you ever wondered what the French toast in Kramer versus Kramer tastes like, or the pumpkin juice or butterbeer in Harry Potter? Maybe you developed a taste for Ratatouille after the animated Pixar movie.
Our next guest wrote a book that will make foodies and movie lovers happy. Andrew Ray is a chef, a filmmaker, a YouTuber, and the author of the new book, Eat What You Watch, a cookbook for movie lovers. Andrew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Well, Andrew, I notice food in movies, I guess, sometimes, but you really pay attention to it. What got you interested in the food in the movies and then recreating that food on your own?
It was always something that always caught my eye. One of my earliest food film memories was the abandoned feast in Jurassic Park, when the kids go through that harrowing ordeal and they come back and there's all these jellies and ice cream and all this stuff. And that's one of the most memorable moments of seeing movies when I was a kid.
See, I remember the dinosaurs, not the jelly.
Were there dinosaurs in that movie?
I remember the jellies too, actually. They were quivering and stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that's how you knew the dinosaurs were coming, because the jelly in her spoon was quivering.
Absolutely, Rob. Did you even see that movie?
Well, yeah. But again, the T-Rex has kind of overshadowed the food. But for me. Yeah.
For you. Well, Andrew, I want to ask you, movies and food seem to be your calling, and you started a series, Binging with Babish. Can you tell us about how that came to be?
Very much on accident. I was always obsessed with food and film, and I had to choose culinary school or film school. I went to film school. I was in post-production, commercial post-production, and I just decided to keep food alive as a crazy hobby that I would stay up until 5 a.m. working on. And I bought a camera and a light to do some freelance work, and decided to just set it up in my kitchen. And I did one episode just thinking, you know, this will be fun, and people liked it, so I kept making it. Now it's my full-time job.
And how central is food to a good movie? What makes a good movie food?
Well, I don't know if food is totally essential to a good movie, but it's present in so many iconic movie scenes. And for some reason, when you see it in a movie, you want it more than you might normally want. So many people asked me to recreate the pasta from Elf, even though it's clearly disgusting, but something about it draws you to it. And I think that food can be just as much of a character, particularly in food movies, as the actors themselves.
And we have, we're going to talk about that recipe, but let's get in the mood first.
Absolutely.
So where were you for the last 30 years? North Pole.
Can you pass the maple syrup, please?
I didn't put it. It's spaghetti.
You know what? I think I have some. Yes.
You like sugar, huh?
Is there sugar in syrup?
Yes.
Then yes. We elves try to stick to the four main food groups. Candy, candy canes, candy corns, and syrup.
And hence the dessert breakfast pasta. What is in that stuff?
Everything that you loved as a kid and now it can't stand as an adult. It's got crumbled Pop-Tarts and caramel sauce, chocolate sauce, marshmallows, M&Ms, maple syrup. I could keep going. Every candy your parents wouldn't let you have.
And there's pasta in there somewhere, too.
Yeah, somewhere in the bottom, ironically, there's pasta.
Okay,
for breakfast.
So what's it like to actually eat this?
Oh, it's disgusting. It's abhorrent. But people are curious about it. It's one of the most famous scenes from that movie, and people were dying to see it. So eventually I caved around the holiday season last year and made it for the show, and it's even in the book.
I'm pretty sure my daughter would eat that. I don't know if I want to try, but I'm pretty sure she would eat that.
The worst part is that I had to eat it three times because
time
I had, like, the lens wasn't focused correctly.
Oh, no.
So I had to do it over. And then now this came over and they wanted me to make it for their show. So I ate it three whole times, which was awesome.
Is there another movie besides Elf that people really connected with the food in it and wanted to see you make it?
Particularly food movies like Chef. People really wanted to see, and animated shows, because this book is all about movie foods, but I do also do television show foods on the show, and things like Bob's Burgers, which all surrounds food loosely. People were dying to see all these sort of whimsically named burgers, and Adventure Time is a cartoon that millennials are obsessed with, and they wanted to see this sandwich called Jake's Perfect Sandwich that has a T-bone steak and a whole bird and eggs and all. It ended up being about 8 inches tall. People want to see those, particularly appetizing-looking things over the disgusting, usually.
We're talking to Andrew Ray. His new book is Eat What You Watch, a cookbook for movie lovers. Let's let the movie set up something that I think people actually enjoy consuming. Here's a listen from Harry Potter.
Does anyone fancy a butterbeer?
So butterbeer is a thing. I looked at the recipe. It looks drinkable.
Yeah, that looks delicious.
What goes into butterbeer from Harry Potter?
Well, it's described as frothy and sweet and mildly alcoholic, which is odd because all these kids drink it.
Yeah.
So just enough booze in there to intoxicate a child. Not that that's what we want to do, but that's the measurement we're going for. So we're looking at it's got a base of cream soda, and to make it extra frothy, there are shaken egg whites, some butterscotch schnapps, simple syrup for extra sweetness, and a little bit of vanilla extract and heavy cream to make it all creamy and frothy and just a little bit alcoholic.
Now, I happen to have this one. It was delicious at Harry Potter World in Los Angeles. How does it compare to that one? Are they similar?
I have not personally tried it, but I read an article that when they opened that theme park that visitors were in tears from finally drinking it, something that
they were
wanted
really good
and wondered about for so long.
So J.K. Rowling didn't put a recipe in there for this, just a description. What's it like to either, read the book or watch the movie and then try to reconstruct as best you can the recipe?
Well, it takes a whole bunch of research. It really depends on the source material. For instance, the strudel from Inglourious Basterds, the Quentin Tarantino movie, it was made back in World War II, and I wanted to really emulate like an Oma recipe for how they would have made strudel. So I just dug through all these archives of people blogging about their grandmother's recipe and eventually settled on one where you have to stretch the dough out to the size of the table and it becomes so thin you can see your hand through it.
Wow.
And then you brush that entirely down with butter and roll it up and use that to make like flaky layers. So sometimes it takes a lot of research. Sometimes it's totally spelled out for me. Like in the case of, pasta aglio olio from Chef, you see him make it step by step right there. So I can imitate it accurately.
Why do you think it is so weirdly compelling to see people eating in the movies? But I also feel this in books, too. And I think of a show, for example, not a movie, but The Gilmore Girls, where they're constantly eating. And that seems like the creators of that show knew that people wanted to see them eating and just kept throwing it in.
Absolutely. I think it's because it's something that's most potentially tangible about the things that you love, either books or movies or TV shows. It's something that you could potentially try yourself. And it's a way of immersing yourself in what you're watching. And I think that that's the draw.
Now, a rough ballpark percentage. How many, Andrew, of these recipes that you've recreated are actually good, that you enjoyed eating?
Well, in the book, I'd say there's 41 recipes, so that means there's 40 recipes in there that are good.
Plus the spaghetti?
Yeah, plus the spaghetti, which is not. It's just in there for fun. And as far as the show, I think I've done in excess of 60 episodes now, and there were some real stinkers in there. And there were some that were, I'd say it's a 50-50 mix, because sometimes these things are designed to be purposefully disgusting, like the elf pasta that's meant to gross you out and make you go, eh. And there was no improving that one. Often I try to make my own version where it's the good version of this fictional food, and I was not able to do that with the elf pasta.
And what about, was it the blueberry pie from Stand By Me? I mean, I love pie, and yet somehow I don't know if I want to make that pie.
No, yeah, it's a kind of not a great foods scene if you're trying to keep your appetite, but it's, I don't know, there was something appealing to me about that. It was also an excuse to get a pie recipe in the book, because I love pie, and I didn't want to do American pie. That seemed a little
yeah,
I wouldn't know.
Yeah.
Just leave out the castor oil and you'll be good.
Talking to Andrew Ray, chef and filmmaker, telling us about his new cookbook. It's called Eat What You Watch, a cookbook for movie lovers.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are there movies that always manage to make you hungry? Has Hollywood ever inspired you to try or to make a new food or kind of food? Is there a recipe from a movie that you want to try to make but don't know how? Maybe Andrew can help you out. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And we'll continue our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
Hamburgers, the cornerstone of any nutritious breakfast.
What kind of hamburgers?
Cheeseburgers.
No. Where'd you get them? McDonald's, Wendy's, Jack in the Box. Where?
Big Kahuna Burger.
Big Kahuna Burger. That's that Hawaiian burger joint. I hear they got some tasty burgers.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're picking up our conversation with Andrew Ray. He's a chef and a filmmaker, and he's telling us about his new cookbook. It's called Eat What You Watch, a cookbook for movie lovers.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have any favorite movies with food scenes in them? Is there something you've tried or made that you saw in a movie or want to try? Call 800-642-1234. Maybe we'll check out that Big Kahuna Burger in a bit. Let's go right to our callers now, though. Travis is with us in Manitowish Waters. Travis, hi.
Hello. How are you?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Travis?
I wanted to talk about the rum ham from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
I do not recommend the rum ham.
was no way possible to make an alcoholic rum ham taste good. It kind of burns it all off when you actually cook it.
Well, I mean, I don't think he ever cooked it. I think he just took a cooked ham and soaked it in rum. And not only is it gross, but it's not even going to get you intoxicated. It's not even going to get you drunk. So it's just pointless.
But you did try this one, Andrew?
I did try that one.
You soaked the ham in the rum.
Yes, and I wholeheartedly would like to ward everybody off from anybody who wants to try that. Bad move. Don't do it.
I mean, yeah, life lessons from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Basically do what they don't do, I think, is a fair statement.
All right. Sorry about the bad news, Travis. And we're going to go next to Gail in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi. Oh, this is inspiring me. I'm going to have to get the movie out again. I'm wondering if you've ever seen Babette Feast. And if you haven't, it's incredible. The whole movie is about a dinner, and it's such a fabulous dinner, and the backstory is just beautiful.
I think you have, right, Andrew?
Not my most recent episode, but my episode before that was Cayenne Sacrifage from Babette's Feast. I love that movie. A lot of my audiences are millennials, so it's very hard to recommend that to them because a lot of that movie is people staring wistfully out the window. But it's a beautiful film, and at the end there's this wonderful feast. You're absolutely right. And the one that always caught my eye was the Cayenne Sarcophage, which was quails in a puff pastry sarcophagus. So if you check out my YouTube channel, you'll see one of the most recent episodes is from that very film.
And we're looking at the picture in the book. And I got to say, yeah, Andrew, come on over and make this for us. I don't think I'm going to try to put this one together myself.
I don't know if I want to eat anything with the word sarcophagus in it.
It is off-putting, but it's fabulous. And yeah, the version in the book is a little bit more accessible because the one in the movie is made with hunks of black truffle and foie gras and quail. And it's very hard to get hold of those things. It was very difficult for me to source them. So the one in the book is a little bit more accessible. It's made with black truffle oil and Cornish game hens. It's things you might be able to find at your supermarket.
Thanks a lot for the call, Gail. We're talking to Andrew Ray. His new book is Eat What You Watch, a cookbook for movie lovers. We have a couple of recipes that he shared, by the way, linked on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back to our callers now. Fred is on the line in La Crosse. Fred, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
I've loved The Big Lebowski since the first time I've seen it, and I've seen it many times. And the scene where the three of them are sitting in the car eating In-N-Out Burgers. So earlier this year, I was in Las Vegas for a family wedding, and the first place we went to eat was at an In-N-Out Burger point.
Good move.
And we ran into Mike Daniels, the Green Bay Packer, there.
No kidding.
Wow. Yeah.
Nice. Fred, thanks a lot for that call. I would think if Big Lebowski inspired people to consume anything, it would be the drink, the White Russian.
Yeah, the White Russian. And I also did an episode on movie cocktails. White Russian was in there. And I totally forgot that they had In-N-Out Burgers. That's a missed opportunity for me because those are great burgers.
Can be an upcoming episode.
Yeah.
Well, Fred, thanks a lot. And we're going to go next to Erica in Kenosha. Erica, hi.
Eric.
Oh, I'm sorry, Eric.
Yeah, that's
apologies.
Okay. No worries. In Kenosha, yeah, I was totally inspired many, many years ago to just become a cook. Not professionally, but to enjoy cooking and get much more into cooking from an old French film called La Grande Bouffe. And the food they served in that made me hungrier and hungrier. It was just amazing classic French cuisine that was being served all day and all night as part of the plot of the movie.
La Grande Bouffe. Does that ring a bell, Andrew?
Yeah. Are they sort of, it's like a group suicide pact to eat themselves to death or something? Yeah.
It's a very dark film, and they decide they're all chefs. Or their friends of chefs.
No, wait a minute.
Suicide by eating themselves to death.
This inspired you to cook at a reasonable level, though, right, Eric? Just, you know, for normal consumption.
Yes.
Good. Okay.
If suicide's occurring, it's only very long term.
Okay.
Well, yeah, no, that's the very definition of indulgence, I guess. And I have not seen it, but I have heard of it. It's pretty notorious.
Well, speaking of bouffe, though, you have the bouffe bourguignon from Julie and Julia in your book.
Yes, that is my absolute favorite dish to make, so I insisted that it be in there. I have a pressure cooker version in there. It's something that I've been practicing for years, and I love Julia's method, and... more modern methods. I love slow and low meals because it just shows you how foods and flavors can change over time with minimal heat. It's a very interesting way to learn how to cook.
Eric, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Daniel in Wisconsin Rapids. Daniel, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to mention the movie The Big Night, which is all about cooking and two immigrant Italian brother chefs who are going to throw a big dinner party with the very last of their savings to try and save their restaurant.
Daniel?
It's Tony Shalhoub, and I'm not going to get the other actor, but just
Stanley Tucci. Yeah. Andrew, thank you for that call. This is your number one Oscar-worthy food performance, and you've got the big, huge dish they make at the end, the timpano pasta?
Timpano, yep. That was my second episode I ever did of the show.
Wow.
I made it when I still had a full-time job So I had the idea to make it the same night that I got home, and I worked until 6 in the morning, went to work, came home, finished it, and we didn't. I had a bunch of friends over, and we ate around 10. We were all starving and delirious.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was a magical experience. It fulfilled every hope that I had from watching the movie, which is maybe one of my favorite movies and definitely the best food movie ever made.
Daniel, thanks a lot for that call. And we'll go to another one from Kathleen in Madison. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I was thrilled by this subject since it's my hobby to replicate food in movies and in television.
Oh, cool.
Something in common. What have you done, Kathleen?
Well, I made the timpano as well.
Wow.
And I did the entirety of that Babette's
feast. Oh, my gosh.
With quail, with truffles.
Like you should be writing the book, not me.
Well, and we offered it as the leading prize for the hospital at which I worked for our United Way fundraiser. And it was purchased by one of the vice presidents. And we replicated the movie. Not because we plan to, but because at first there are people looking down, you know, good Wisconsin Lutheran types looking down going, you don't mean it's really made out of turtle, do you?
Yeah, how'd you
and
do
by
that?
The end of the evening, everybody is bubbly and talking and asking for seconds.
Wow, what a magical experience and a lot of work, it sounds like, Kathleen.
Oh, it was so worth it. I did an entire dry run. 22 years later, a man came up to me a few months ago and said, you don't remember me, but I was at what you called your dry run for that feast.
Wow, so that's memorable. That's really getting at something. And that's what you're talking about too, Andrew, that this isn't just, you know, kind of a passing lark. There is some sort of internal connection with this food stuff that's powerful from the movies.
Yeah, and there's something special when you get to actually try it yourself. There's something special that happens that you feel more connected to and more a part of what you love so much. And Kathleen, next time you're doing that, let me know. And I'd like to come over, please.
And Andrew, before we run out of time, I teased the Big Kahuna Burger earlier from Pulp Fiction, and you've got a Hawaiian burger to replicate it. What's the secret in making our own Big Kahuna Burger?
Well, you know, Hawaiian burger, pineapple is of course going to be on there, but then to sort of offset the tartness and sweetness of that, we got teriyaki sauce. And the most important thing you want to make a fast food style burger is to make smash burgers. So you form a little meatball about 2 inches wide and put it in a very hot pan, smash it down with a big flat spatula, and that's going to get you this really crispy on the outside, juicy on the inside, diner style In-N-Out style burger, and that's the key to making a great fast food burger at home.
Yeah, it sounds pretty good. And Andrew, last question as we wrap up, what's next on your list? You've done this whole cookbook. What are you going to cook for us next?
Well, I'm actually trying to figure that out right now. I think this week's episode is going to be Michael Scott's the Works pretzel from The Office. It has 18 different toppings on it, cotton candy bits, white chocolate, dark chocolate, all this different stuff, and gives them a huge sugar high. So I'm gonna see what that's like. And I have a new show that just came out called Basics with Babish that's an instructional series for those who want to grow their skills in the kitchen.
Andrew, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, guys.
We've been talking to Andrew Ray. He's a chef, a filmmaker, a YouTuber, and the author of a book that combines all of his interests. It's Eat What You Watch, a cookbook for movie lovers. That book's out now. He joined us to tell us how to make some of the most iconic meals featured in popular movies. You can find a few of the recipes from his cookbook linked over at the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Well, if you haven't figured it out already, today happens to be Friday the 13th, and it falls in October. And
so Halloween's coming.
Halloween is coming, which is kind of the right ambiance you want for Friday the 13th. It was not, however, the day that I wanted to break the mirror in our office. That's got to be bad luck.
For you, maybe. I was out of the office at that moment, so I didn't witness it. You didn't. We did not find any glass particles embedded in you.
No, I think there might be one in my finger.
Okay. Well, all right. A bit of bad luck there. So Friday the 13th. When we were recording a promo earlier, we really kept stumbling over it and having to restart. That's bad luck, not a reflection on our skill levels at all.
Right, but what if the mirror was telling me that I'm, like, the unfairest in all the land?
No, I don't think mirrors really have that level of depth and intelligence.
You're superstitious, though.
Only when it comes to the jinx, the power of the jinx. People deny that at their peril. Otherwise, not so much. But one superstition here at WPR is when it's Friday the 13th, donuts appear.
And that's good luck.
Right. It's not really a superstition. One of the guys, Peter in IT, always brings in donuts on Friday the 13th. I think to cancel out the bad stuff going on.
And today, did you notice that they were flanked by a pair of black cats on either side of the donuts?
Yeah.
They were still tasty.
The cats? The donuts.
The donuts.
The donuts, of course.
Yeah.
All right. Stay lucky out there. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.